Kag, greetings. This is Captain Cordan Sutai Krenizan, commanding officer of the Global Fleet, here in another installment of Meet the Global Fleet Officers. Today, doing the recording is Lieutenant Commander Jia Jin. Good day to you, Lieutenant Commander. How are you today?
Come on, doing well.
Oh, that's good to hear, good to hear. And today, we are joined by Commander Mektor Sutai Kuvaj, Matthew Henkel, hailing all the way from Japan today. Good day to you, Commander.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Very good, although it's an early evening for us. it's a Sunday morning for you as we're
doing it.
An early Sunday morning.
It's not so bad. It's about 9 o'clock now. It's just morning.
Okay. Well, again, still thank you for joining us and being able to.
Thanks for having me. Today.
Definitely, definitely. So, Commander, let's get right into it. There, can you tell us a little bit about your?
My name's Matt Henkel. I'm an English teacher in Japan. My family, my wife's from the town I live in now in Japan, which is a small town on the Sea of Japan side. And we moved back here about almost 10 years ago now. That's pretty much the daily thing is teaching English and you know, two kids, pretty much.
All right. Now you're southwest of Tokyo, correct?
We are kind of northwest. We're almost dead west.
Oh my!
Of Tokyo, we're like if you kind of imagine Japan like a banana. We are on the inside elbow of the banana.
Gotcha.
So we are about we're almost. I guess I would say we're almost straight north from Nagoya. And relatively north of Osaka, Tokyo ends up being way out to the east for us, across the Alps.
How many hours would you say you're away from Osaka then?
Osaka on the express train, it is, I believe, two to three hours, depending on which train you take.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Very good. And you've been in Japan for 10 years. Where are you from originally, Commander?
I've been in Japan longer. I've been in Japan this time, 10 years. I've spent about half of my adult life in Japan, either working in Japan or back in the States. It's kind of been back and forth. I was born in El Paso, actually.
All right.
My dad was an officer candidate at the... Air Defense Artillery School down there. So I was born in El Paso. And then when I was about 6 weeks old, we moved to Mannheim. And I spent the first 2 years of my life at the end of the Fulda Gap waiting for the Soviets to invade.
Uh-huh. Very good. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, any army grunts in the audience definitely know about the Fulda Gap, and any history buffs definitely for the World War II battles that were fought mm-hmm. there. Now, so you're an army brat, but what got you to Japan in the first place?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I do remember when I was a kid watching Shogun, and being very interested in Shogun, and then. You know, I'm an 80s kid, so the 80s were a fairly fetishized Japan kind of popular entertainment, ninjas and things like that. So that was probably the start. Talor, who
Japan
is...
Japan of War? There we go.
Yeah, you know, that early... Before the bashing started in the early 80s when... when it was the cool thing, the seed has to be started there. I grew up after we moved back to the States. We moved around a little bit until I was in about second grade, and from second grade, I lived in an apartment complex in the suburbs north of Pittsburgh, which is a relatively, you know, white suburban area. However, our apartment complex was like this bastion of immigrant families. So I grew up mostly with Taiwanese American families in that immediate area. So all of, it sounds like a joke, but I literally knew the families that owned every single Chinese restaurant in like an 8 mile radius.
Okay. At an early age, acquired an appreciation of Oriental lifestyle.
That was the culture I grew up in. I just grew up with, you know, the Wongs and the Tsangs, and the Lus, and those were just the kids that I hung out with. We were in apartment buildings, so the kids that lived in the houses were like, oh, you know, there was a kind of economic and quite likely racist barrier between those two groups. We would get on the bus together, but we didn't hang out together. Right. And you know, Taiwanese kids at the time, you know, there was a lot of interest in Japanese culture at the time.
Uh-huh.
So that's probably another factor in it, where, you know, we were playing things like ninja based stuff and those kind of things were just kind of there the whole time. And I'm sure other influences, other friends that I had that were interested in Japan rubbed off on me a little bit. And then I do recall going to the library. I think I was in junior high school, and I decided I was going to learn. I was going to learn Chinese.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because I grew up with kids that spoke Chinese, so I was like, I'm going to learn Chinese. So I'm going to go get a book at the library, because my school didn't offer anything. And I went to the library and I picked up the first book on the shelf for Asian languages, which was a Teach Yourself book for Cantonese. And I took it home and I opened it up, and none of the letters matched any of the sounds on the CD. Or it was actually, I think it was a cassette tape at the time that I also had borrowed to go with it. And anyone who's studied Chinese knows that the romanization of Chinese is not clear. The sounds do not match what you initially expect those letters to say. So I took that back, and the next language on the shelf was Japanese.
Okay.
So I grabbed that book and I did the same thing, and I got the cassette tape and I took it home, and that matched. You know, when it was a K, it made a K sound, and when it was an SH, it made an SH sound. And so that was a way I could actually process the information and learn. And so that started kind of like a, you know, that started maybe the direct connection to Japan maybe starts there, because that's where I actually had to make the choice of which language to learn.
Right.
And then through college, you know, I did an exchange, and then the better I got at the language, the better, you know, the more invested I got in coming to visit, and it kind of turned into and the more time I spent visiting, the better I got at the language, and it kind of turned into that kind of cycle. And so after college in 2001, a month after 9/11, I came to Nagoya and I started teaching English. And since then, you know, probably about half of the time has been either teaching English in Japan, teaching elementary school in the States, until we came here in 2012.
Very good, very good. Now, that's a fascinating background there. A lot of stuff going on there. But what got you interested in playing Klingons and portraying one in your adult life?
It's interesting. It actually goes back to the same, you know, some of the same things. Before we moved to that apartment building, my mom taught at a high school in rural southwestern Pennsylvania, and she was an art teacher, and some of the student, the high school students would hang out at a bookstore, which was one of the only interesting places to hang out in this little tiny town. Right. Science fiction paperbacks and things like that. And there ended up being a group of kids playing the old FASA Star Trek role-playing game.
Yes. Wonderful. I loved it.
With the unked dice that were actually 20-sided dice numbered twice.
Indeed.
So it must have been 1983.
I still have my old character sheets, definitely.
Yeah, and I remember we were playing the Klingon supplement had just come out. We had gotten it, basically taken it back home. It had been unwrapped. I mean, I'm in first grade. Yeah, I'm a little kid at this point, but we crack it open, and so the group, which is, you know, essentially my mom and her friends, not really me. I had a character named Cap. Which I remember specifically because Sean, one of the older kids, who was probably a high school student at the time, was saying, "Who the hell is Cap?" And I was like, "Hey, that's me." And we played the, I believe it's the bundled adventure where you have Romulan prisoners on the ship, on a D7, and they try to escape and you have to kind of stop them, which I think is, it might even actually be the reverse. It might have been you were supposed to escape from it, but we had set it up where we had the main player, the main body of players were playing Klingon officers, and then one player, Eric, who is T'Lor on my roster, who has been a friend of mine since at least 1982. Okay. He was playing the Romulan. And he had the entire, he had us absolutely befuddled. He escapes from the brig, he raids the armory, and then he starts using the turbo lifts to send overloading disruptors to main engineering, the bridge, all these places. And the adventure ended with the main characters in a shuttle, adrift because the ship had been destroyed. Completely befuddled as to how anything happened, because we'd been running, things would explode, we would run down there to try to find out what it was, but he wasn't there. And that was the beginning of playing Klingons. And
were you a fan of Star Trek or the Klingons the role-playing game?
Star Trek was always on the TV, syndication at the time, early 80s, it was on all the time. So that was something that we watched regularly.
Okay.
And then the movies. Around the same time we begin flirtation with organized fan clubs, which did not go well. There was a lot of gatekeeping and in-group and out-group problems, and basically we had wanted to join a group, but they didn't like our costumes, or they didn't think that we matched their look or whatever it was. So we were not invited to join the premiere of Star Trek III in downtown Pittsburgh. My mom, who's also my exo, Morta, she wasn't going to take that laying down. So she found out that there was a convention out at Parkway Center Mall. And they had a costume contest, which would result in the winners getting tickets to the premiere. And we went in as Andorians, and I think my dad was a Federation officer and a borrowed Monster Maroon.
Okay.
And we won. And so we ended up going to the thing. And I remember we actually saw the people from that ship, and they wanted to know why we were there. And we were like, "We're not here with you. We have our own tickets. Thank you."
Gotcha. Yeah. And
that soured us on Star Trek clubs for a while.
Okay.
The Pittsburgh chapter that club. I don't even know if I should even bother mentioning their name, but that club rubbed a lot of people. That club rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking now that we're talking about it, we're talking about the time period, mm-hmm. and you know the what was it at the time of the second movie, The Wrath of Khan. It's around 82, 83. I can't remember the time frame.
I remember going to the first meeting that we attended was in like a church basement, like a rec room kind of thing. Right. And I remember Wrath of Khan was on a Betamax VHS player.
I think I'm getting at is at that time, I don't think Trek fan clubs were really organized very well because they didn't know how to govern themselves at the time.
They were,
not near the major populous cities like New York City or Chicago or LA or even maybe in Miami. And you had these people with different attitudes about how to run a club, and you know they weren't as well organized as our founder wanted and achieved CAG to be. And like you said, it probably turned off a lot of people's attitudes to joining and enjoying Trek fandom that we know and love nowadays.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that it was pay to play. It was a little dictatorship. It was kind of the worst things that you could expect from fandom with a capital F kind of thing. And so we stayed away from it, and we didn't do anything. And then Next Generation comes out. We move out when I'm in sixth grade, we move out of the apartment complex, into a house, our first house as a family. And, the house is like an old Victorian with, that we got from this old lady. And she had these velour, like heavy, velour drapes that in retrospect would have made absolutely fantastic velour command tunics from original series. They were like the perfect color. Well, they were the perfect color for how that color reads. They were kind of they were more yellow. They weren't as green as the actual tunics were, but for the way that color reads on the screen, they were like a perfect match. But anyway, and then this has got to be 1989 is my guess. Michael Dorn is scheduled to be the guest of honor at Creation Con that I think it was that summer. And so we would pull down these drapes because they were fairly ugly. And I cut one up into like a tunic. And I pulled out the Klingon, the FASA Klingons book, and I flipped it open to the shot where they had the uniforms for the Romulan fusion and the human fusion and the Imperial. And I used that as my guide, and I used a purple Sharpie marker and a ruler. And I made Imperial armor pattern on this yellowish mustard color velour pattern. Kind of an odd choice.
Okay. I'm just thinking Dayglow right now, but go ahead.
No, it wasn't Dayglow. The purple kind of came out as this darker color on it. So it actually made a fairly good contrast. It was purple because the black one ran out. I mean, it was basically doing what you can, what you have.
Gotcha.
And then my mom had the idea, the bottom of the curtain had this weave. It was a flat weave that braided. It was two pieces that kind of oscillated back and forth over each other. And it was made out of something like burlap or something like that. And so my mom took that, cut it, hemmed it, and turned that into the command sash.
Okay.
And I wear like, you know, black pants and black shoes and black turtleneck. And I stick this thing over top and I have a belt and, you know, and I go to the convention and I'm in sixth grade. So I'm kidding. And I go and I win the contest for, I should mention, I did makeup too.
Okay.
It was two dimensional, but it was textured so sure. that I would look like a Klingon. And I go and do
the same thing at one time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we did what we could because we didn't know how to do anything else.
That's right.
And I remember Michael Dorn standing there with his hand on my shoulder and him saying, I like your sash better than mine. I think I won tickets to the next convention. I won the for the age there. And that started like, okay, I'm going to do costumes at conventions because I can win at least tickets to the next convention.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm in junior high school, so I don't have any money.
Yeah, right.
So this starts, and there's a progression of talent as I go through this. So the next uniform is also Klingon because you go with what wins. This one was made out of gray corduroy, which was a very good color match to the armor, with duct tape metal edging. Like it was just duct tape. Metal edging. And it was a much more accurate image of that, if not anything near screen accurate. And we'd gotten better at shading and making the forehead look like it was actually three dimensional.
Sure.
So I did that costume and I go, this has gotta be about a year later, I guess. So it's gotta be early 90s by this time. I don't remember. I think at some point in the middle, I think I'd gone as a character from other science fiction, but I end up going back to Klingon. And sure. So I go in and it was, and I win. Again, I win in my class, which is again, basically you get tickets to the next convention. But at this convention, is Kurge T'Chukma, who was the commanding officer, founding officer of IKV Dark Justice in Pittsburgh. Okay. And Kurge was a student at Art Institute of Pittsburgh. And he had, you know, used all of that to make essentially a screen accurate costume. It was vinyl and metal, and it had a command cloak, and he had foamed latex appliances, and Damien had full dentures too, so he had filed teeth too. He had a dental appliance as well, and so you know you're walking down the hallway in corduroy and duct tape, and then a guy looks like he just walked off the screen, walks past you, and I was like, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and definitely.
I find out, I go down to the comic book store because I'm in junior high school and you hang out at the comic book store at that point in time, which is run by Eric, who is the Romulan that ruined our game in 1982. and there's a on the bulletin board is a recruitment flyer for Dark Justice. And I pull down one of the little tabs and Eric says, yeah, that's Damien. He's a friend of mine. He's a regular here. He's a pretty good guy. And I didn't know it was the same guy. But I'm like, well, you know, it's free. Let's go down to the library and try it.
Okay.
My mom is not really enthused by this because she has nightmares still of the horrible experience that we had previously. But we go and we end up at the meeting. It's still, I mean, Dark Justice is still a fairly young ship at the time. If I remember correctly, Cordite had joined the week before or the month before we had. So that would put it, I think, early 91 or no, I guess it'd be 92, be around November. Around November of 92 would be my guess. And that's where it starts. So that's where my actual progression into CAG starts there.
Okay. Well, before we get into that, Mactor, there's, a plethora of stories out there for the fan. Mm-hmm. What other sci-fi stories or attracts you at all?
What kind? I'm a big Heinlein fan.
Okay, Heinlein. Yeah. A lot of people, I'm finding out, especially over in Europe, that Star Trek is not really as pervasive as it is here in the U.S. And like you just said, they're exposed to Heinlein and maybe other of the big name sci-fi writers. And I'm just curious, and we all know that Japan is big on different types of futuristic stories. There's Robotech and other things that came out in the 80s. And, Star Trek, is Star Trek the only thing that occupies your sci-fi mind at this time?
For mine, no. I like all kinds of science fiction. And our group is in structuring the group, one of the things that we really liked when we joined CAG was the kind of looseness, the kind of the opposition to the clubs that existed at the time, whether it was IFT or SFI or whoever it was at the time, which was pay to play. There's a boss and you have to, there's a chain of command and stuff like that. And CAG was like, we're here to have fun. Rule number one is have fun.
Yeah.
And that really impacted how we did things. And I think, by the time I get into college, late 90s, as Star Trek is waning in popularity and fandom is kind of taking a downturn, CAG itself went through a kind of growing pain of people wanting to have more control and things like that, which kind of turned off a lot of people. And we ended up joining Demon Fleet, and then I think pretty much the rest of CAG joined Demon Fleet. and the idea was to get back to that early version of CAG. And that, before John passed, a lot of my connection to CAG over the last 20 years has just been John.
Yeah.
Back from when he would write messages on my handwritten messages on my copies of Mind Scanner.
Right. Exactly.
To the internet and things like that. And, John was a busy guy, so we didn't talk all the time, but every once in a while I could count on getting a message from John saying, hey, how are things going? And I would bring up problems that I have and he would say, try this. And that was the way. And he's like, do it however you want to do it. Do it so that it's fun. And that was the thing that he constantly said that it needs to be fun. It doesn't need, you don't need to worry about it being screen accurate. You don't need to worry about this. You get t-shirts with a all over print Klingon uniform. He's like, there you go. Your uniform. And his flexibility in what it means to be part of this fandom was the most valuable thing I learned from him. One of the things that turns me off about things like the 501st or other groups that are predicated on screen accurate uniformity of uniform is that inherent gatekeeping that happens with that, whether it's financial, whether it's ability, whether it's physical, because someone's body type doesn't match what they're supposed to look like on screen. Uh-huh. And the CAG idea from John was, that's bullshit. we do this, you do this, how you do this.
Right.
And that's an important thing that I learned from that. So now our approach to science fiction is very open. You know, you like Ghostbusters, fine. You want to hang out with us? Sure. Okay, let's hang out. And so we'll talk about Ghostbusters, we'll talk about Star Trek, we'll talk about whatever it is.
Sure.
And that kind of just let's just be geeks together. Yes. However you want to do it is fine. Yeah. We'll learn something from each other anyway.
Yeah, as long as we're all having fun and we like our geekiness,
right.
Let's enjoy it. And if we see a couple of actors from the shows that we like, mm-hmm. that's all the icing on the cake that we need. So there you have it. Definitely.
And we each of us brings our own view of what we like. I am a classic Trek person. I'm the kind of person that when people say like, oh yeah, I like old Trek, but it just looked so cheesy. I'm the person that goes, Hey, that stuff stands up. You know, I get defensive of the old designs.
Yeah. And it's started everything that we enjoy nowadays. How many years after that it came out? And people still reference it in the shows coming out now.
Right.
So how can you slam a classic?
Right.
You know, that's like slamming.
You gotta respect your roots is my thing. And that's my view. So I am a classic. I am primarily, let's say, a classic fan.
There you go.
But, other people are Next Generation fans, or other people are Deep Space Nine fans, or other people are Discovery fans, or everybody brings their own kind of fun, and that's fine. So sometimes people ask us like, well, what era is your ship? And I'm like, yes.
Yes.
The answer is yes.
Right. Yeah,
in my brain, it's an animated series D7.
There you go.
In your brain, it can be whatever you want it to be.
Right, exactly. And that would bring me to my next question. Who would you say is your favorite Klingon?
Oh, that's really hard to say. I mean, of course it's going to be Kor. I mean, who doesn't say Kor, right? It's got everybody has to love Kor.
Yes.
You might like Worf, but everybody loves Kor. So, Polikos is number one.
Oh, definitely. In fact, I was just watching the DS9 episode Once More, Unto the Breach. And, it was really hard not to get a little misty-eyed going off on his last mission in the Ning Tao to hold off the Jem'Hadar 10-ship fleet with only one bird of prey. And just his style of acting and, I always keep in mind how he appeared in the original series and how they translated him to DS9 technology. Mm-hmm. And like you said, you just cannot help but love the way he portrayed his character.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely. I mean, the way, like, regularly among my group, someone will say vegetable. it's always there.
How many times do we look at something and just sit there and say, glorious?
So much of what a Klingon is defined by that first performance.
Yes, yes. And then, what would you say would be your favorite Klingon episode?
Well, I should mention that, Kor is there, but I do like, the other one that I like, to be different from everybody else's answer is, Kolath is excellent. Campbell's, my second favorite. Everything he's done is enjoyable. But if I'm going to choose one that's, one that someone else didn't pick, it's going to be Torg from Star Trek III. Yeah, everybody's going to go with, you know, if they're going to choose that, I mean, Krug is fantastic, of course, but everybody knows Krug is fantastic. Right. And, you know, John Larroquette is enjoyable as Maltz too, but I'm going to go with Torg.
Yeah.
You know, just, I really liked the look of his character. The makeup on him really spoke to me as a Klingon. That character, I can remember being a kid watching the VHS copy of Star Trek III and being drawn to his character, not just because he gets blown up, but that's a great scene. But I, you know, the way he answers questions, when they watch the Genesis device and, Core shows you what the captain acts like, right? What the boss acts like. Torg showed me what the lieutenant acts like.
Okay.
So those would be, if I'm going to pick two Klingons that I consider definitive, that would be it. It would be Kor as the leader and Torg as the subordinate.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice choices there. And, you know, and I'm sure he had different scheduling techniques, but that would have been fun to have seen a John Larroquette come back into the fandom to reprise his role as a Torg.
John Larroquette is Maltz. John Larroquette is Maltz.
Fault.
Torg is what's his name? I can't remember the actor's name. Steven. It starts with an L. I think he's from Pittsburgh, actually, too. He was in Night of the Creeps. I can't think of his name right now. I can see his face. It starts with an L.
Okay.
Steven something. Yeah. It's not going to come to my brain, but
during the Kirk's trial,
Steven Liska. That's who it is.
And even during Kirk's trial here on Earth, it was suggested that Maltz was standing next to the Klingon ambassador as a witness. And it just would have been just to give it more flavor from, a secondary officer's point of view, to hear some more, lines from John Larroquette, because he's just a wonderful actor to begin with, and what would have happened with that character. So yeah, that would have been pretty nice. Definitely.
Yeah, I would like to see. I mean, I would like to see. Yeah, I like seeing the actors. So yeah, you're right. It would be nice to see something maybe in the animated shows, you know, like in Lower Decks, definitely. having a voice revisit would be a nice touch. Story, you mentioned stories, and that's a hard question. I mean, again, it probably goes to Errand of Mercy as the definitive one, because it was just so, you know, it's the first one, and it so well sets up the, you know who the Klingons are, what is the dynamic, how does this work. But if I can kind of maybe more liberally interpret the question, Star Trek III would be my favorite Klingon story.
Okay.
I just like that one. I mean, the reason that I probably made that Klingon costume to go out of that curtain to go to the thing was probably because I watched Star Trek III a lot when I was a kid. That was for some reason, that one spoke to me more. As an adult, I watch Wrath of Khan way more than anything else. But as a kid, Star Trek III was the one. Maybe it's the one that I remember going to see in the movie theater first. I know I saw Wrath of Khan in the theater, but I don't have a strong memory of it. I do have a very strong memory of going to see search for Spock. So that's probably, that's not a really great portrayal of Klingon honor in that one, but it's some really fantastic performances.
Yeah, indeed. And it just, it gives us at the time, gave us more of the Klingons, which at that time was basically a desert. The motion picture, we have Mark Leonard and his crew and his task force there was like a little Klingon oasis that, the Klingons did make it over into the movies.
Right.
And then we get back to Star Trek III and we get a little bit more. We see the more elaborate uniforms. And of course, Catherine Schiff as the lady at the beginning of the movie. And it's just amazing. It's just like opening a door on a almost completely different world. Well, let me say that a Westerner first going to Japan and the culture shock right there.
I think that 80s portrayal of Klingons, right? So you're right. We don't have a lot of Klingon stuff, and we get that little hint in the motion picture, and then you get Final Reflection, which is a fantastic book and defined Klingonness for a lot of people of my generation. That was the Klingons that the Klingons that the way we understood Klingons was through the lens of John Ford.
Definitely.
And that book directly influences the FASA supplement. I have to wonder that was it the sales of that book and that supplement that kind of steered the story back to the Klingons? Because it was supposed to be Romulans in Star Trek III.
I wasn't aware of that.
I believe they were supposed to be Romulans in the original thing, and then it changed to I could be misremembered. This could be rumors from pre-internet days that are wrong. I'm not sure. The way I remember being told the story was that it was supposed to be Romulans. Then the next draft was that it was going to be Klingons who stole a Romulan bird of prey.
I see.
And then that progressed to, and the reason that they changed it was because nobody wants to see Romulans. People want to see Klingons.
There you go.
But that, I think that portrayal, and one of the other great things about Search for Spock is the specific samurai stylistic choices they made in costuming for Christopher Lloyd. They gave him that kind of laid back top knot hairstyle.
Okay.
And they introduced the command style armor with the slightly robe like closing, and then the command cloak to give it this samurai esque thing. I think that's even in the notes from the costume designer. That was a specific choice, and that ties into my experience with being interested in ninjas and samurai at the time, and then Klingons are basically space samurai, and that makes this perfect storm that ties in to the trajectory that my life was taking.
Yeah, Paramount, they really gave us a treasure trove when delving more into the Klingon race and the lifestyle and the ships, just everything. It's just like you're at a all you can eat buffet and you're there and I want more, I want more, I want more. So definitely, Star Trek III really busted it out for us.
Yeah, and Next Generation also leans into that, Klingons as samurai kind of idea. Later we start to get more Viking kind of influence in it and stuff. But the Russian, the Soviet read of Klingons is kind of, not abandoned, but it's played down through the late 80s, Right. And so the more we learn about Worf, the more it seems to be this samurai-esque kind of culture with ritual suicide and with, you know, and honor being everything. And that, you know, like I said, that matched the interest that I had. And as a CAG member, things that I, you know, read and studied, now I had a way that I could, you know, actually inject knowledge into conversation and bring in, you know, if this is the symbolism, well, this is another thing that we know about this culture. So we can adapt that into this fictional culture that we're interested in.
Yes. Yeah. Now, getting back to a CAG, of that track again, you mentioned the costuming.
Right.
And the appeal of not strict adherence to anything, right, any one thing in particular, but, you know, like, and the turnoff from other fan clubs or fan clubs in general. Was there anything else that attracted you to CAG as opposed to the IKEF or Kai or what, any other larger group of Klingons in the U.S.?
We didn't have really any, Pittsburgh did not really have any significant presence for any of those groups. It was the Potemkin for Starfleet International. It was the Galloway for IFT. And that was pretty much it when we started. As time goes by over the next couple of years, we get other than Gamma Knights. There was a Maquis Raider or something like that. I think there was a Klingon Strike Force attempt that did not go well in Pittsburgh, or did not take off as far as I know. But one of the things that my family, from when my mom, when I was a kid, it was primarily my mom's interest, my mom and my dad's interest in being involved in fandom. And a lot of that was charitable. And part of the disagreement that they had was the way that Potemkin wanted to do their charity was very nativistic. We're not going to help foreign kids. We're going to help American kids because, you know, we take care of our own first, which contradicted my parents' view of what Trek was trying to the world that Trek was trying to give us, was that we were all in this together. And that was a significant turnoff for Eric and my mom and, you know, the older people that were older than me that were leading that interest. And when CAG came along, you know, blood drives and bowl-a-thons, and, you know, it was just like, let's go out there and do some good, and we're going to help people. And we're just going to help people. And we're not going to argue about helping people. We're just going to help people.
Right.
And we're going to do it. And that became, I think, a cornerstone of my understanding of what Star Trek fandom in particular consists of, which is, you know, costumes and movies and books and all of that. That's part of it, but that's not really the key thing. The key thing is the humanism, the positive, the purposefully optimistic, the decision to be optimistic about humanity and to be optimistic about the future.
Yes.
And to work together towards that goal. And that definitely affects, I mean, and John was definitely one of those kind of people. I mean, he was definitely right. And that's what really cemented. I have been a member of so many Star Trek clubs. I've tried again and again joining different clubs to expand my network of contacts. And they have almost always all resulted in terrible experiences with racism, with sexism, with homophobia, with things that I could not wrap my head around of why this is has anything to do with Star Trek. Like, how can you watch the show and maintain these ideas? And the one club that I've never, ever renounced my membership in has been CAG. And that was because of the way John set it up. Because it got it right. So that's the primary appeal to being a Klingon and to being a CAG Klingon. And I think it's CAG is more important than think that. I was like, oh, we're going to be Klingons. But you know, now I don't think it, like I said, we're trying to be an open umbrella and we want everybody under our tent. And if you don't want to be a Klingon, that's fine. Come and you know, that's the point. And you know, my roster is 53 members right now. Only like 8 of them are Klingons. It's like, you know, there's not very many Klingons in that. Actually, I think it's higher than that. I think I have 12 Klingons on my roster.
And also, there's groupies involved as well that they not necessarily CAG members, but they support and go along with you and the regular CAG members out there to help you guys.
Right. We play together and we accept them. And I'm setting it up and I'm running it with CAG kind of guidelines and stuff like that. But it's not a show your membership card or you can't enter. It's come on in. This is what we're doing. I got my adjudicator t-shirt on. And, if you want to do it with us, we'll get you a t-shirt. If you don't, still hang out with us and let's do some good. Let's go plant some moss at the shrine. Let's do some walking for charity. Let's do whatever that is. We want the help. We want the partnership more than we want you to put rubber ridges on your forehead.
That's
minor detail.
Well, Commander, what can you tell about a Mektor Kuvaj? What is or who is your CAG persona?
Mektor, the persona was, it took a while to get to that name. It took me a couple of, I think my first name was based on a watch name, which was terrible. And I think that didn't last. And I was like, this is awful. I'm going down the wrong one. And I got a Klingon dictionary. I got Orkran's Klingon. Actually, I think maybe Cordite gave it to me, or maybe my mom had one in her paperback collection and I dug it out. And I pulled out sections of words with no concern at all for the grammar.
Okay.
Excuse me. Thinking that, names are not necessarily grammatical. So I'm just going to put sounds together that reflect that inspire the idea of these images. So I think I got Kuva first, and that was supposed to be honored. I think honored warriors, I think, was the original idea. And then I eventually decided, well, I really like the sound of Kuva. And, that was pretty much it. It was just like, okay, that's the house. And then Mektor, I don't even remember how I got to Mektor. I guess I'm sure it was pulling pieces out of the white cover edition of the Klingon dictionary with Maltz and Kruge and Torg on the cover.
Yeah.
he kind of existed without any real identity. Cordite did a lot of writing. So Cordite would we would go to meetings and Cordite would have written a story based on, most of the time based on role-playing games that he had played in college, adjusted to fit the lore of the ship. And the Dark Justice was supposed to have been a T-12 Carrier of Doom class ship, which was chosen.
That's the Fat Man assault ship.
It is the giant one. No, it's not the Fat Man. That's a battleship. The T-12 is the one that looks like a turtle with two big long arms sticking out on the side.
Oh, yeah. I know it's an assault ship. Yeah.
It's a troop carrier. And okay, it was chosen because it was the biggest ship in the FASA ship. And, you know, Cordite, it wasn't Cordite, it was Courage. We had, I think at the time, we had one of the largest rosters because Courage would recruit every single person he met that would talk to him for more than 15 minutes. He'd be on the bus. He'd be sitting next to somebody. Do you like Star Trek? And he would chat them up. And, you know, a man of many faults and stuff. I've had trouble with Damien in my life, but Damien is still someone that was very influential in my life and someone that, I am a better person for things that he has taught me directly and indirectly. So one of the things that absolutely is incredible about Courage, who I believe is retired from CAG, but is still around there, was that he was so absolutely charismatic and able. He was one of those people that had this magical ability to just draw people in that I have never been able to do.
He'd be able to sail snow to an Andorian or what?
He was incredible. I don't know how it was. He's a short man. He's a little bit strange looking, but he was absolutely charismatic. So we had this massive roster. I think before Cordite got a hold of it, Courage was not the best at keeping records. But I think when Courage left, Cordite had something like 200 people on the roster. Wow. And we had to like go through and find out, like, are these people actually interested in being on this or not? But anyway, so the lore of the Dark Justice was when we were at this massive troop assault ship, which did not have a cloaking device, which bothered Courage. So Cordite writes a story about us capturing a Romulan Stormbird that has a Borg drone on it. And the Borg drone is then integrated into the ship's computer system to improve systems and provide power for a cloaking device. And that had kind of established Dark Justice as a next generation ship.
What about your persona?
So my persona kind of came from that. I think I mentioned in a couple of Cordite's stories. And I was the force leader. I'm mentioned as a Marine in a couple of the stories. And then later, I think after the book Kalis comes out, I tied into that and the house was founded during the Mythic Age. We had warriors that fought with Kalis against Molor and had been an influential member of the High Council until being on the wrong side of the assassination of Chancellor Gorkon, when they were stripped of their house and their holdings and were persona non grata for the next 100 years until they supported Gowron and as a reward for their service, the house had been recently reestablished. And that gave me the fact that it was a new house, but it also gave me the fact that it had some history, a lot of history.
Okay, good.
And then that's where the character came from, was really that. He wasn't based on a role-playing game character. Cordite's was based on his character from a game.
Okay.
But mine was just kind of created there. And then Cordite as a member of CAG, really, I guess, gets born when I started making fun of the Imperial Xeno Legion at Camp Dover, which started, in retrospect, a lot of it is kind of gatekeeping that I wouldn't do anymore. But at the time, when you had so many different choices for your Klingon fandom, our feeling was that you should be we're Klingons, be a Klingon. Don't half-ass it and be a munchkin And we were approaching this a lot through like a role-playing game, kind of a min-max player. And we had a local guy who wanted to be everything. And he was a Klingon and a Romulan and a Thought Admiral and a Cardassian and wore a kilt. And you know, it was everything. And it was an absolute mess. And he wanted to join our group. And he thought he should be a colonel because he did something else. And we were like, no. And I did a cartoon of him. I was making the list of everything that he was, and he's a half Romulan. And it's like a paragraph and a half of different things. And I was trying to think of Nausicaan, and I couldn't think of the name. And so we're in the car. I think we're driving to Dover, maybe, or me and Cordite and Courage in the car. And I'm like, what were the name of the aliens that stabbed Picard in the chest? And Courage says, Snossigens. you know, Snossage is the dog treat.
Dog, right,
and
right.
This results in about 15 minutes of just side-splitting laughter. And then, but we decided that, you know, Snossigen is a wonderful term for the kind of fan that has to be, that has to create this story of being the best of everything, right? The superlative thing, rather than just being and doing something and getting your laurels from what you do. It was this creation of that. And there was a lot of that. We had a guy, I think he was on Potemkin, but he might've been on Galloway, who had this Klingon uniform that was the same color as rental bowling shoes and walked around with a Muppet. He had a Muppet that was like a ventriloquist puppet. And he was also part Borg because he'd been the story was he had been assimilated and then had destroyed half of the race of Borg when he rejected assimilation. And we were like, well, that's ridiculous. And you know, why don't you do something and then be notable because of what you've actually done rather than this fictional thing. And so that's when Snossigen was born. And okay. Snossigen was that kind of fan.
I see.
And definitely rooted in a role-playing in a poor role-playing character idea. And
gotcha.
Like I said, probably a narrow, rather gatekeeperish kind of view.
Well, in different times. Different times. Now, as being Mektor, does he face any challenges, or are there any particular likes that Mektor looks out for?
I talk a lot, and I'm not necessarily diplomatic in it sometimes. So my major things was, at Camp Dover when Xeno Legion was announced, we were at the back table, me, Courage, and Cordite yelling Snossigens at the back. And we were not, Clang was not, I think it was Clag. No, it was Clag. Clag, he was the guy that started it. And I did a cartoon right there on the table of Clagzilla. And we started doing this, all these different like absurd mashups of Klingon and other science fiction things. And, you know, Klingon versions of the Three Stooges. And
okay.
And that became very popular. I think one of the cartoons went into, the second issue of Heart of Glory, I think it was. And that's where I got my... That's where my name got out there, and that's how I made my entry into the Demon Fleet was, the meanness with which I could go after people in authority for things that I thought were silly. And then from that, things in fandom generally turned down in the mid to late 90s. And so we don't do a lot there, but we had already, you know, by that time, Dark Justice had destroyed all the other fan clubs, which is one of the things I know I've told you this before, the Dark Justice War book really, really makes me mad because it doesn't reflect anything that we did, because it says that Dark Justice didn't do anything. And it's true, we did lose a bowling match because Starfleet cheated, but we also had immediately raided them back after they raided our meeting. Cordite made an order for a whole bunch of Starfleet International manuals, like the Marine manual and their security manual, and just bought them under the name Cordite. And okay. They shipped them to them. And it was like, well, intelligence gathering is excellent. And we did paintball with the Marines from Potemkin, who were the ones that started the raid. And they didn't show up. That we had, Jay McPherson was the only one that showed up. So we had done, we did a lot of challenges and they wouldn't show up because I guess we intimidated them. By the time, around that time, Federation Science exhibit goes around and ends up at the Pittsburgh, science at the Carnegie Science Center in Pittsburgh. And, we were contacted, for the launch, which was, we were supposed to come in costume, and the boxes were arriving, and we were going to be on the news, and we did this big thing, and I'm marching with a staff member in a Federation uniform, you know, like holding his arm behind his back, and you know, marching him down the ramp, and it was this great thing. And then I think that was the day that the low speed Bronco chase happened for O.J. Simpson, so we got bumped from the news. but the Science Center loved us. And so we, along with other, all of the groups, all of the science fiction groups, sent volunteers to work at the Carnegie Science Center, and they were mostly terrible. They wanted to get in for free and look at the exhibits. They didn't want to do the work, but we had a lot of teachers. We had a lot of people that were really interested in volunteer work. And so we were reliable. We were good volunteers. A lot of Dark Justice ended up working as actual staff for the Science Center because we did that. And that was our main victory. Is that at one point the director of the Science Center, in talking to the other groups, said, "If you were lucky, you'll get to work with the Klingons." And that snowballs through to invitations to do stage security for Seventh House, a local band at their concert, and from the mayor's office to sing Christmas carols in the subway in Pittsburgh, and all of these things. Bayer Haunted Trail gets us, and we do Bayer Haunted Trail for charity, like 7 years in a row. We destroyed the competition. And by the end of the 90s, we were the last group left. Nobody else was left.
Yeah, and that's the type of recognition, good recognition that a Trek club really wants. So, Majka on that, Commander. Very good. Well, we're getting to the end of it right now. Only two more things to go. Sure. You're in Japan, you know, when we hear Japan and their different fandoms out there, you know, people think of the different comic fandoms out there. Yeah. But I'm just curious, can you tell us about your region's or your area's attitude just about sci-fi fandom, and if there is a good following of Trek fandom in your area, not necessarily the whole of Japan itself, but centered around Osaka, fandom around Osaka.
Yeah, I'm not in Osaka. I'm in Kaga. Osaka is probably more active. Where we are, which is fairly rural. I would say the attitudes that I see are like the way Star Trek was treated 30 years ago, when it wasn't really cool to be a Star Trek fan. You know, comic book movies, it was a niche fandom, and it was an outside group thing. It wasn't this, mainstreaming of geek culture that we see, over the last 20 years.
Right.
It's still fairly similar to that here. There is still a kind of eye roll when you say, I like Star Trek or Star Wars or Ghostbusters or whatever it is, to the point that I'm going to put on a costume and walk around in it. There is some fandom. It's mostly Gundam based.
Yeah, because I see a lot of cosplayers on Facebook, and there are all these cartoon characters that are just taking out of paper comics or televised comics or even the video games that we play.
Yeah.
And
I sometimes see people wearing like Gundam field jackets or something like that. But even that, people kind of cross the street when that comes down the street.
The icon of George Takei from the original series, do they not approve of Mr. Takei's acting or his tie-in with Star Trek? Or
I don't think they have any concept of who George Takei is. I don't. I really don't. I think older people would. People my parents' generation.
Okay.
Probably, but I think even my generation, I think people are like, who? I don't think there's that much concept. Part of the issue that we have. I mean, our group is mostly expats. I guess would be the way that you would say it. I don't particularly like the term expat, but that would be. But most of our group is guys from Australia, Scotland, the States that came here to work, and we ended up, hey, I like Star Trek. Let's do some stuff together. So that's our core, like our local core group that is Star Trek focused is basically that. And we basically got together because we all realized we like Star Trek, and Star Trek Online was a thing. And we decided to play online together. And then I decided, maybe we should try making a group and do some volunteer work. And so we kind of did that. And, we have, we have, I guess you would say locals, but they're connected to us somehow. They're sister-in-laws or wives or kids or things like that. So we don't get we have not gotten a lot of traction with the local, with local people yet. We do our volunteer work. We have t-shirts that we wear when we go and we do that. We get appreciation for our group, but we haven't gotten a lot of, hey, we want to do this with you.
I see.
So there's an acceptance of the work, but maybe a polite eye roll after they turn their head about the mania involved in it. But it's very much like trying to do this 35 years ago. I mean, that's what it's like.
I get you.
But the more difficult part of it is that, with Paramount Plus pulling their titles, there is no Paramount Plus in, or whatever it's called now, in Japan. There's no release date for it. So any traction we were starting to get with the new shows being on streaming out here has been kind of undercut by that pullback. And there is, we do get Picard, and I assume we're going to get a third season of Lower Decks. I don't know. But even Picard just came out, what, yesterday?
Yes.
There were no commercials. There were no trailers. There was nothing. It was Picard season one only on the app until I checked after watching Marvelous Mrs. Maisel last night. And that's when I found out. I was like, hey, Picard did come out. And so there's, you know, it's that hampers us. There's not a lot of advertising that we can benefit from for Star Trek properties out here. So gotcha. that gives us a further uphill battle.
I see. Mm. Well, Commander, what would you say would be your future plans inside CAG here?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if I have major plans. My goal was always to kind of do what we're doing, which was to have a group that was accepting and more accepting than I was in my youth. And, you know, to be the kind of person that, you know, I was lucky to have in, you know, I'm about 11 years younger than Eric, who was the guy that ran the comic book shop and played that first game and designed our logo. And, and I'm about the same difference in age between me and Cordite and Courage. And so they were the like older brothers that kind of, you know, gave me the place to find acceptance. And so the goal was always to do the same kind of thing for other people. And I think we're doing that. We're not getting the traction that we'd get, but then again, Star Trek isn't getting the traction that it used to get back then either. So,
right.
You know, that probably is the reason that we're a wider net now. And so we're like, well, we're going to do this for anything, whatever you want to do. We're going to provide a framework for you to find resources that you need. You want to find out how to make three-dimensional makeup, whether it's a Klingon forehead or whether it's, you know, a Star Trek alien or a Star Wars alien or whatever, or horror movie, whatever. We have people that have that expertise that can teach you that. And that's the idea, is to kind of provide a clearinghouse of old school expertise for the new school members. And to provide a place where everyone can play how they want to play.
Very good.
And play, to provide that play, support.
Play and play safely, definitely.
Right. And that, you know, that was, and again, that's all formed by the experiences that we had where people were telling us how we could play and how we needed to play and what we needed to do. And we were like, no, we don't want to do it that way. We want to have fun. We want a group that encourages everyone to have fun. Whether my idea is the same as yours. I said, I'm an old school Star Trek guy. I'm not incredibly happy with the more cynical view that the new series takes on humanity in the future. And right. I miss that perhaps naive optimism that was inherent in the old shows. And that's a shift that happens with Deep Space Nine. I know it goes back and I know there's a track, but that's not what appeals to me personally. But that's not what the next person is going to be interested in. And it's not my job to say that they need to like old Star Trek better than new Star Trek. That's not my job. My job is to say, you like Star Trek? Well, here, I have some resources that will help you do what you want to do, whatever that is.
Yes. And
while we're doing that, the one thing that I am going to impress on you is that you need to get out there and make the world a better place. And you can do it, and it's easy, and here are some ways that we can do it together. So that's the only requirement for providing resources, for providing, you know, this connection to to other talents that will help you do what you want to do. The cost for that is we want you to help make this place better. So
that's it. Outstanding, Commander. Outstanding. Well, this has been a very illuminating hour or so talking with you. Is there any parting thoughts that you would like to leave with the audience, Commander?
Just that's, you know, that make the world better. The world is full of a lot of negative stuff, particularly recent.
Right.
And it's only like that because we fool ourselves into this thing where we can't do anything about it. And you can do whatever you do, whatever little you can do, has a some effect, and it goes together. And if you give up, if you let other people do that stuff, then the evil, the negative wins. It's hard to stay optimistic.
Yeah.
But that's Roddenberry's major gift to us as an artist was that part. It wasn't spaceship designs. It wasn't costume designs. It wasn't pointy ears on aliens. It was that almost childlike optimism that no matter what we're faced with, it can and it will get better. We can do it.
Here, here.
That's what I would say. That's what everybody has to remember.
Excellent. Very good. Very good. Well, Mector, is there, if anybody wants to reach out to you, near Kaga, Osaka, Japan, however they want to remember you by, is there ways people can get a hold of you? Facebook, Twitter? How does that happen?
I don't do Twitter. Probably part of that negative thing. So we do have a website. There is a Blogspot blog. I will send that on. We also are trying to revamp our online presence to make it a little bit more updated and stuff like that, and address privacy concerns that members have, and kind of balance how much we can share with how much we need to protect in the modern world. But you can find us there. You can find us on Facebook. We are bundled in, like I said, we are a multifaceted fandom. So IKV Adjudicator is part of the Rocket Punk Space Patrol.
Okay.
And that's where you can find us. That's where you can find us on Facebook. So yeah.
Very good. Very good. Well, again, we've been talking with Commander Mector Sutai Kuvaj, Matthew Henkel, Commanding Officer of the IKV Adjudicator over in Japan. Also, yep. We've been joined by Lieutenant Commander Jia Jim of the IKV Battle Teak, the Commanding Officer there. And gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. I hope everybody listening enjoyed this talk with Commander Mector here. And until our next installment, to the Klingon Assault Group and my officers in the Global Fleet, Kai Global Fleet, Kai Kag.
Kapla.